My name is Barbara Rossing, and this is the second in our series this week on miracles in the Gospel of Luke, treasure in Luke. And today we're going to look at Luke 7. But I want to do just a little introductory stuff beforehand. Yesterday we started with Luke 4 and looked at the first sort of miracle story that Luke gives us, the exorcism of this demon that the man had. Today we're going to look at two healing stories. One, a healing of someone who's at the point of death, and the other of someone who's actually dead. The first story in Luke is told also in Matthew, but the second, the healing of the widow's son at Nain, which was the gospel passage in the Sunday lectionary 2 weeks ago. It's interesting, now we're looking at Luke 7. This is our gospel chapter for these past 2 weeks, two stories from Luke 7. This story is unique to Luke. Luke is the only gospel writer that tells us this story. And I think at least a lot of commentators would argue that what's important about both of these stories, at least one of the things that's important about them, is the way they establish a connection between Jesus and the Old Testament prophets, specifically Elijah and Elisha also. That the way Luke decides to tell us these stories heightens some of the connections so that good Jewish readers, early Christian readers who also knew the Old Testament scriptures really well, would click in their mind all the, who knew the Old Testament, who knew Elijah and Elisha, who knew those stories, would see the great similarity between Jesus, the new Elijah or the new prophet who has arisen doing miracles like Elijah and Elisha, is doing things very similar to these Old Testament prophets who were held in such high esteem. Luke, more than any of the other gospel writers, makes this attempt to establish Jesus as the new Elijah. And we talk about, I don't think we think about Elijah in the same way that the Old Testament people do and what it means that Jesus is the new Elijah. But anyway, I think that's what's going on here in these stories and in this chapter in general. Just to jog your mind, a little bit review of what we did yesterday that I think is important to keep in mind. As Jesus preached his inaugural sermon, you know, where he starts in the synagogue in Nazareth, he opens the book of the prophet Isaiah and reads that passage, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, who has anointed me to preach good news to the poor, you know, sight to the blind," that whole stuff. Then he closes the book and says to them, "Today this scripture is fulfilled in your hearing." Then the people are already starting to wonder the big question of the Gospel of Luke, who is this? Isn't this Joseph's son? You know, who is this? What's going on? And then Jesus says prophets are never acceptable in their own country. So he calls himself implicitly a prophet, you know, by saying that, you know, you reject prophets in their own country and that's what's going on with me. So he already is making the suggestion that he's a prophet. And then he tells two Elijah and Elisha stories that I think are important today as we look at Luke 7. The first, he refers to them, but we want to go and look at the stories themselves and see what's going on. The first is, "I tell you, there were many widows in Israel when Elijah," "there were many widows in Israel in the days of Elijah when there was a great famine, and Elijah was sent to none of them, but only to Zarephath, to the widow there." So he is recalling already the Old Testament story that we'll look at in a few minutes, where Elijah multiplies the food of this widow and heals her son. And then the other story he refers to is, "There were many lepers in Israel at the time of the prophet Elisha, but Elisha healed none of them, but only Naaman the Syrian." So already Jesus, in referring to himself as a prophet, alludes to Elijah and Elisha, to these two stories, and gets people very offended, of course, in Nazareth, because the implication is, "I'm coming to them and not to you." So they're upset and try to kill him. And then he goes on and does his first exorcism. That's what we looked at yesterday. So today I'd like to start out by actually looking at those two stories in the Elijah-Elisha cycle, if that's all right with you. Let's look at the Naaman the Syrian one first, which we'll find in 2 Kings 5. 1-14. This is just one. It's interesting. I was reading these chapters again, 2 Kings 4 and 5. If you've got time sometime, you might want to just sit down and read these two chapters, 2 Kings 4 and 5. Because Elisha, I mean, really goes to town on doing miracles here. There's a lot of miracles in these chapters. One of which we looked at last week, interesting, I just want to refer to this because I think it's so interesting, which I think is the Old Testament background to the story of the feeding of the 5,000, which I had never seen before last week when we looked at this story. But anyway, that's at the very end of 2 Kings 4, where there's a similar kind of deal where Elisha says, "Give to these people that they may eat," and his disciples say, "How can we feed so many people?" In that case, it's 100, whereas in Luke, it's 5,000, of course. But he says there will be enough. Give it to them. And they fed them, and there was enough and some left over. Very much like the story of the feeding of the 5,000. Elisha and Elijah both do a lot of food miracles, a lot of things related to the famine that's going on in the land there. So anyway, we've just read that one, and now we come to Naaman the Syrian. Does someone want to read 1 to 14 here in 2 Kings 5? It's kind of a funny story. I really like it. Okay.
Naaman, commander of the army of the king of Syria, was a great man with his master and in high favor, because by him the Lord had given victory to Syria. He was a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper. Now the Syrians, on one of their raids, had carried off a little maid from the land of Israel, and she waited on Naaman's wife. She said to her mistress, "Would that my lord were with the prophet who is in Samaria, he would cure him of leprosy." So Naaman went in and told his lord, "Thus and so spoke the maiden from the land of Israel." And the king of Syria said, "Go now, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel." So he went, taking with him 10 talents of silver, 6,000 shekels of gold, and 10 festal garments. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, which read, "When this letter reaches you, know that I have sent to you Naaman, my servant, and that you may cure him of his leprosy." And when the king of Israel read the letter, he rent his clothes and said, "Am I God to kill and to make alive, that this man sends word to me to cure a man of his leprosy? Only consider and see how he is seeking a quarrel with me." But when Elisha the man of God heard that the king of Israel had rent his clothes, he sent to the king, saying, "Why have you rent your clothes? Let him come now to me, that he may know that there is a prophet in Israel." So Naaman came and with his horses and chariots, and halted at the door of Elisha's house. And Elisha sent a messenger to him, saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and your flesh shall be restored, and you shall be clean." But Naaman was angry and went away, saying, "Behold, I thought that he would surely come out to me and stand, and call on the name of the Lord his God, and wave his hand over the place, and cure the leper. Are not Abana and Pharpar, the rivers of Damascus, better than all the waters of Israel? Could I not wash in them and be clean?" So he turned and went away in a rage. But his servants came near and said to him, "My father, if the prophet had commanded you to do some great thing, would you have not done it? How much rather then when he says to you, 'Wash and be clean'?" So he went down and dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the word of the man of God. And his flesh was restored like the flesh of a little child, and he was clean.
So just to summarize the story, it's a foreigner, it's Naaman the Syrian, and it happens that there's a Jewish girl that had been carried off who tells him that in Israel there would be prophets or there would be someone to heal him. So he, the king writes this letter and sends Naaman, and he goes, and the king of Israel, of course, is terrified. Because he thinks it's a way of starting a war with him, because he doesn't know how to cure leprosy. And then Elisha volunteers. And the interesting thing here is that Elisha does not actually meet the guy, right? I think that's, at least the people who say there's a connection with the story in Luke 7 point to that as one of the things. Elisha does it, he says, "Let him come to me," but then he sends a messenger. The guy halts at the door of Elisha's house, but Elisha sends a messenger to him saying, "Go and wash in the Jordan and you shall be clean." So he himself never meets Naaman, right? And then I think this is a really funny line where Naaman gets all upset and says, you know, is that all I'm supposed to do? We've got better rivers than this back in Damascus. You know, our rivers are a lot better than the Israeli rivers. You know, I could just as well wash in them. So, you know, he too has a little bit of national pride here and gets upset. But then finally does it and is cured. Any other comments on this before we look at Luke? And of course, when Jesus picks up on this in Luke 4, what he's doing is reminding us that God is a God who all along has visited foreigners, that salvation and healing are not reserved for the Israelites, but embrace people of other nationalities as well, as we see with Naaman the Syrian. But that's not so much the theme in Luke, although it is here too, a Roman centurion. It's not a Jew who Jesus is going to heal. All right, well, let's turn to Luke 7, and maybe, you know, we'll see both similarities and differences, but you can just keep this in your mind as a background item. Certainly the people of Jesus' time and Luke's time would have known the Old Testament and knew how to make connections between stories that had similarities. So as we read this one now, see what you think about possible similarities, differences, questions that it raises, neat connections or dissimilarities, whatever. Luke 7, 1 through 10. Somebody want to read this?
I'll read.
Okay.
After he had ended all his sayings in the hearing of the people, he entered Capernaum. Now a centurion had a slave who was dear to him, who was sick and at the point of death. When he heard of Jesus, he sent to him elders of the Jews, asking him to come and heal his slave. And when they came to Jesus, they besought him earnestly, saying, "He is worthy to have you do this for him, for he loves our nation, and he built us our synagogue." And Jesus went with them. And when he was not far from the house, a centurion sent friends to him, saying to him, "Lord, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. Therefore I did not presume to come to you, but say the word, and let my servant be healed. For I am a man set under authority, with soldiers under me. And I say to one, 'Go,' and he goes, and to another, 'Come,' and he comes, and to my slave, 'Do this,' and he does it." When Jesus heard this, he marveled at him, and turned and said to the multitude that followed him, "I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith." When those who had been sent returned to the house, they found the slave well.
Comments? What strikes you in this? I'll just say one thing about this whole issue of these sort of, you could call them distance healings, that I think is, I don't know what to make of it, that there's not very many stories like this where Jesus heals at a distance. He doesn't even go and touch the person or anything like that, you know, or take spit and put it on their eyes or anything like that. But at a distance, he proclaims that the person is healed, and they are. And the other one, this is the only one in Luke, I think. The other one that's the most famous is the story of the Syrophoenician woman, which we don't find in Luke. We find it in Mark and Matthew. And that's the woman who sort of converts Jesus, in a sense, you can say, to seeing Gentiles as deserving also of healing, in that she asked for healing for her daughter, and he says it's not fair to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs, you know, that story. And then she comes back and says, "Well, even the dogs get crumbs." And then he says, you know, "Go your way, your daughter is healed." And there too, the daughter is healed at a distance without Jesus ever touching her. And it's also a non-Israelite, so I don't really know what to make of that, but it's interesting that these stories are rather rare and that it's usually Gentiles. So that's just one thing, but what else, what do you see as connections, differences, or interesting points?
I guess I see one interesting contrast here between these two we've just read. The king of Syria wanted himself cured in a very ceremonious and spectacular way. The centurion was just the opposite. He said, "Don't bother with with anything. Just say the word. The simplest thing was satisfactory for him here. And this strikes me as a great, what is emphasized here is the idea of faith that Jesus could do this. But I think there's also, comparing these two, the element of humility, that I am thankful just for being cured. I don't want or need your personal attention, a big ceremony, make me the center of attention. Whereas the king of Syria,
Naaman the Syrian, not the king, but yeah. Yeah, he says, behold.
Obviously wanted a lot of attention. And I think this is something we should keep in mind with our receptivity to healing, that a lot of times the idea of God coming in some spectacular way and healing us appeals to us, to the extent that we're unable to recognize God's action in healing us in many less spectacular ways, which is really the more common way that he works.
Great point, thanks. You had a comment over here?
I was going to say, I think it's interesting that when the word is spoken, that something happens. That there's action, that there's healing, there's love, to a certain extent, some compassion for the long distance healing that is to take place. And once again, I think that relates also then to our lives, when the word is spoken to us, or when we live out the word in our life, that is accompanied with action.
Yeah, it's a really powerful view of word, right? He says, only say a word, and that effects an action. What other things, events, does that remind you of where a word can do that kind of power thing? Well, creation, right? Where God creates the world with a word. God just says, let there be light, and there is light. I mean, where the word of God has this power to effect already something tremendous, yeah, and the guy really believes it.
And then in Jesus, the word became flesh.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
The centurion brings up the point of authority, and we were just talking about that in the fourth chapter, that, and then he also has this with all the scribes and the Pharisees, continually having a thing with authority. But, you know, in his own country, they're sitting and mumbling and sort of, you know, this guy we grew up with, you know, how could he, you know, really have authority? And the scribes and Pharisees, the law is all the authority. You've got to do it right. You can't do it on the Sabbath and stuff. But here he comments on the faith, but the other person says, I perceive you have the authority. And he's not doing all the nitpicking questioning that the Jews were.
Yeah, it is an interesting thing. I mean, it's sort of like he knows how to recognize authority when he sees it, because he too is under authority as well as over it. Kind of. Yeah, that's an interesting contrast there. And then that, we brought out in the first session, his own kind of, you know, not boasting of his authority, but just sort of saying what his authority is, contrasted with his sense of unworthiness. You know, that the Jews say he's worthy to have this done because he built us our synagogue, but the guy himself is saying, Lord, I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. And that's, you know, that line, I don't know if some of you have been to Roman Catholic churches, where that's the line where they say right before communion, isn't it? Lord, I am not worthy to receive you, but only say the word and I shall be healed. That's the last line, I think, in the Roman Catholic liturgy before you actually go up for communion before the Lamb of God. And I think it's a really neat line. It comes right out of this story here.
Uh-huh. Kind of related with the authority, it's interesting that both the Syrians and the Romans were enemies and also kind of the oppressor of Israel. They both clearly beat up Israel. And so Jesus and Elijah were both the losers. So the winners come to the losers to be healed.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus and Elijah are both very gracious, even though those people are the oppressors. So, and as a result, it's at least clearly in the Naaman, he becomes a sort of secret convert over to Judaism. It says after that he takes some dirt with him, and whenever he makes a sacrifice, he's really making it to Yahweh, not to the God of Syria.
Anybody else?
Uh-huh. I think along that line is this theme of making, how do we make friends of our enemies? Yeah. Rather than fighting back or retaliating, whatever, the healing, what is offered that is helpful makes a difference in terms of what the relationship gets to be later on. A much better approach to.
That reminds me, I'm supposed to do a bookstore plug here. I ordered for the bookstore a commentary on Luke that has really been helpful for me. We used it a lot last week, but I would still recommend it to you this week, by Josephine Masson Verde Ford, called My Enemy is My Guest. It's on the butcher block table as you go in the bookstore on the sort of back left corner by Orbis. And she looks at the whole Gospel of Luke in light of this theme of embracing enemies. And Jesus, sort of his message that goes out to all nations, and how it's a call to us too to learn to love our enemies, and it's really a powerful commentary on Luke, I think, that's been very helpful to me. But she finds that theme in so many stories and really traces it in a wonderful way, I think. But yeah, that's definitely going on here. Well, let's just open one more can of worms before we go on to the next story, and that would be the whole question of faith. I think we'll see a great variety in the New Testament miracle stories, in fact, contrasted with the next story. But anyway, Jesus is connecting the healing here with a man's faith, right? So do you have to have faith to have miracles? Or, what's the role of faith in the whole thing? Is it a prerequisite? Or is it a result? Or can we not generalize? Or what do you think about faith?
I think faith is a good thing.
You think faith is a good thing? Okay.
No, but it's a the thing I think is interesting is it's the Roman officer's faith that cures the servant. It's not the servant's faith.
Mm-hmm.
So his faith affects another person, a third person, who's not even talked about in the story, except for he's sick and then he's healed. So the officer's faith is very great, but it doesn't help him, it helps his servant.
Yeah. And is it his faith that cures him, though, or what? How does faith work like that? I mean,
Jesus is very impressed by his faith, and he talks about in other places where faith is important for healing. So
and like that one village where he wasn't able to do any cures because there wasn't faith there, right? That's probably the most direct one. Yeah.
Well,
anybody
if
else?
If he had not had faith in Jesus, he wouldn't have asked for the cure, and it wouldn't have taken place.
If he hadn't asked for it. Okay.
So
well,
in that sense, evidently his faith that Jesus could and would do this certainly was a requisite for this particular healing to take place.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh.
But I mean, Jesus had already responded. He'd already gone up to where it was close to the house. I mean, he'd already come with him and got very close. So he essentially already said he was willing to go heal the man. Before the faith came up.
There was faith in the fact that he sent for Jesus
the
to
Jews.
Start with.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
but I guess what I'm saying is faith certainly didn't hurt, but I don't see that it was that much the prerequisite. I mean, the fact that Jesus comments on the faith was not what made him decide to heal the guy. He'd already decided he was going to heal the guy, and he accepted the faith as an extra bonus that he commented on.
Well, why don't we just, it's a really interesting question, because in this story, it does seem that faith plays a really important role because the man sends with a request to Jesus. Now, on the other hand, in the next story, it's pretty much the opposite, where the woman is coming out of town with a funeral procession. She has never heard of Jesus, doesn't care about Jesus, is just trying to conduct her funeral, and he sort of interrupts and heals her kid or raises him from the dead. So that's pretty much the opposite, where she doesn't request. And I think what it goes to show is just sort of the great variety of healings that we find. And I don't think you can come up with a theology of sort of here's how miracles have to take place, because there is a variety of some. In some, faith plays a very significant role. In others, there isn't any faith. I mean, and it's not the issue at all. And in some, there's a request for the miracle. In some, there isn't. I mean, there just seems to be a lot of variety here. So I think that's kind of what's fun here. But in this story, faith is important. And Jesus says that. Never, and I think he's saying, you know, not even in Israel if I found such faith. To, again, a reminder that the guy is not a Jew, and yet that his salvation extends to him.
Well, there is still faith in that second one, though, too, of Jesus' own faith. And we kind of assume that Jesus doesn't need faith, but his faith is tempted. And oftentimes the Bible talks about Jesus being faithful. So maybe it's Jesus' faith in the second one.
All right, well, let's just read that second one since we're talking about it so much. And then we'll look at the Elijah story after that. Somebody want to read for us 11 through 17 here in Luke 7? Oh, just to say, now, this is another example of how oftentimes Luke will pair a story of a man and a woman together. That pairing is very frequent throughout Luke. It's kind of neat. And we'll call this the second story a story of a woman, because I think she is the central character, the widow, even though it's her son who is healed. But she's the one who Jesus is responding to, I think.
Soon afterward, he went to a city called Nain, and his disciples and a great crowd went with him. As he drew near to the gate of the city, behold, a man who had died was being carried out, the only son of his mother, and she was a widow. And a large crowd from the city was with her. And when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her and said to her, "Do not weep." And he came and touched the bier, and the bearer stood still. And he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." And the dead man sat up and began to speak. And he gave him to his mother. Fear seized them all, and they glorified God, saying, "A great prophet has arisen among us. And God has visited his people." And this report concerning him spread through the whole of Judea and all the surrounding country.
Okay, and let's look at 1 Kings 17. Hold your finger here, because we'll come right back to this. But 1 Kings 17, 17 to 24. Just to set the background here, Elijah is going around, and he's been told by God, arise and go to Zarephath and stay with a widow who I have commanded to feed you. And so Elijah goes and says, finds her and says, "Could I have a drink of water?" And she gives him that. And then he says, "Could I have some food?" And she says, "We don't have any food. There's a famine." And then he does the miraculous causing the food to last long enough. You know, this whole line in verse 16 there. The jar of meal was not spent, neither did the cruse of oil fail, according to the word of the Lord which he spoke by Elijah. So that already Elijah has done this one miracle of causing the food somehow to last. And now her son gets sick. So let's pick it up with verse 17 here and read to the end of the chapter.
What chapter?
1 Kings 17. Somebody want to read this?
After this, the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became ill, and his illness was so severe that there was no breath left in him. And she said to Elijah, "What have you against me, O man of God? You have come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son." And he said to her, "Give me your son." Took him from her bosom, carried him up into the upper chamber where he lodged, laid him upon his own bed. And he cried to the Lord, "O Lord my God, hast thou brought calamity even upon the widow with whom I sojourn by slaying her son?" Then he stretched himself upon the child three times and cried to the Lord, "O Lord my God, let this child's soul come into him again." And the Lord hearkened to the voice of Elijah, and the soul of the child came into him again, and he revived. And Elijah took the child, brought him down from the upper chamber into the house, and delivered him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son lives. And the woman said to Elijah, now I know that you are a man of God, and that the word of the Lord is in your mouth is truth.
Okay, thanks. All right, so now let's talk about both these stories here, the Elijah one and the widow's son at Nain. Similarities, differences, things that strike you in either one, whether you think there is a connection. The commentators would certainly argue that, see, because this story in Luke 7 is unique to the Gospel of Luke. It's not told anywhere else, and many commentators say that it's, you know, structured to remind us in a lot of ways of this Elijah story. And 2 weeks ago, of course, this was the Old Testament lesson that was assigned to go along with this when it was the gospel text. So you can all, you pastors can tell us what you preached in your sermons, and you parishioners can tell us what you heard in the sermon. But what did you preach?
No, I didn't preach. I was thinking a little there'd be said by the lay people.
Now that's a pathetic. All right, let's hear from the lay people. Do any of you remember what your pastor said? Did your pastor say anything significant?
The pastor talked about death and the various deaths, not physical death, but the deaths that we experience in our lives. You know, he referred it to death of depression and all kinds of things that, you know, that make us, that have an effect on us. And that there is victory in Christ, and that we can have victory over these deaths. That's how he related it. So that was different. I had never heard it preached on that way before.
Our pastor at Holden Village, Carol, preached a sermon about the radical effect of God, and she also brought in the third one, which was from Acts, where the two people lying are killed.
Yeah, that was an interesting connection, wasn't it? At the time, same time as these two people are raised from the dead, Ananias and Sapphira were struck dead because they kept the proceeds from their field.
And she talked about how there is no kind of middle safe ground. It's kind of a life and death thing with the Word of God.
I'm taking back what I just said.
Well, okay, uh-huh.
Well, not being a Lutheran, I didn't hear it from 2 weeks ago on this passage. But back on the authority issue, Elijah runs and takes the kid, you know, away from the gaze of the crowd, up in a secret place, and he sort of entreats God, hey, you know, would you do this? Which is a different authority approach than Jesus, who just commands that it be done and does it publicly without concern that, hey, it might not happen.
Yeah, I think you've picked on the really important difference here, that and even Elijah has to do a little work, doesn't he? Have to breathe into him first. Yeah, he takes him up. Let's look at what Elijah does. He stretches himself upon the child three times, cries to the Lord, O Lord God, let this child's soul come into him again. Well, I guess that's it. Okay, and the Lord hearkened to the voice of Elijah. But anyway, he has to sort of do more. He has to do a lot more. And Jesus, interestingly, doesn't pray to God and say, oh, Lord God, heal this child. He says, I command you, right? He takes upon himself the role of God, sort of, doesn't he? He says, young man, I say to you, arise. So that's a really big switch there. Elijah says to God, heal this child, where Jesus says, I say to you, especially with forgiveness, right?
Right.
You'll never forgive someone
right.
unless they ask right. for it.
Or even in terms of sharing whatever. But it's so much easier for the receiver, I think, to not make them grovel and request. Not that that's what's happening here, but I like that model that is in the second story.
What struck me is the embracing the contraries, as we have this couple of weeks. The rain falls on the good and the bad. I seem to see here the fact that in the case of both of these widows, their faith wasn't really an instrumentality, unlike the case of the general from Syria or the other incident. In fact, in the Kings, you would think she didn't have, but she really doubted.
Mm-hmm.
She says, "Now I know you are a man of God." I mean, before that, she wasn't sure.
Right.
And she really didn't care. So I see a difference there. In one case, it was their faith that was instruments. In this case, that wasn't a factor.
Yeah.
I don't know. I feel that. I don't know if that's the way.
No, I think that's really true. The woman had never heard of Jesus, and she's not demonstrating faith, and he doesn't say she has either.
I'll go back. I think there is some faith here. And like we said, with the Roman officer, it was his faith, but it held the servant. So if we can kind of connect that, it always has to be the person's faith that affects them. If you look at it from the point of view, both Jesus and Elijah are both very strongly moved by these deaths. Okay, they're the people that are moved. The other one, the Roman officer, was moved by the sickness of his servant. It says Jesus was filled with compassion and stopped a funeral procession. Elijah was so shocked that this person died, he went up and cried upstairs on this boy's body, and he was moaning to God.
Yeah.
You know, and both those cases, they had a very personal attitude towards the person to be healed. And so I think their faith was involved in this. For the Roman officer, his compassion and his faith called for Jesus to come. Jesus' own compassion in this case and his own faith, I think, is a very important factor in here. If Jesus doesn't say that Jesus decided to put on a show and say, "Well, I'll get a couple of people to believe me by popping this guy out of the coffin," you know, that's going to really startle him. First thing it says is he was filled with compassion, goes up and touches the coffin, he looks at the woman and says, "Don't cry."
No, I think that, thanks for bringing that up. I think that is really important, that we sometimes, in our individualistic American way, start thinking about faith as an individualistic thing too, that you own your faith, you know, it's another one of your possessions. I've got my faith, you got your faith, my faith is bigger than your faith, you know, I mean, sort of almost competition. Whereas the biblical view is much more this sort of community of faith, where the Christ in me can sustain you in your times of weakness, like Bonhoeffer says, and then the Christ in you can keep me going, and I mean, in a household can be supported by the faith of one person. Yeah, it is much more a notion of, and that someone's faith sustains everyone, yeah, and that it's not sort of a real individualistic thing.
And in connection with the faith, is looking at it in a different fashion, but in both instances, their faith was really increased. A great prophet has arisen among us.
Yeah, that is interesting. In the second one, the people, you know, yeah, the at the end of both these stories is this tremendous acclamation of a great prophet has arisen among us and God has visited the people. So it's, yeah, they realize that something has happened. And then same in the Elijah story, she ends up saying, "Now I know you're a man of God." So even though she started with nothing or very little, in fact wanted to get rid of him, then she does come to that.
Something in that King's passion, the King's portion that has hit me is that the woman comes to Elijah and "What have you against me, O Son of God? You have come to me to bring my sin to remembrance and to cause the death of my son." And it's almost as though because of my good works, this should never have happened to me.
Oh, I kind of read that as because of my bad works, this should have happened. I mean, doesn't she acknowledge that she's got sin, or I don't know?
I've done these good works. Maybe I'm reading into it, feeling that I was hoping it would cover everything.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know what to make of that.
In the Good News, it's translated, "Did you come here to remind God of my sins?"
Huh. And it's certainly that idea that sickness is, you know, retribution for bad deeds, isn't it? Which we still have a lot sometimes, that you get sick because you sin, or your kid dies because of your sin, which was the Old Testament text last week with David's sin and the death of his son. It's a scary idea. just the question, what have you against me? That's what the demons said in Luke 4, if you recall, that when Jesus comes to exorcise that guy, the demons cry out with a loud voice, what have you against me, O Holy One of God? You know, that they're the ones who are scared to have Jesus intervening in their life because they've got a nice life inhabiting this man and they don't want to get exorcised. So it's kind of funny there, that question is transposed. Okay, well, let's pick up, and I just want to do a little bit with the whole question of who Luke is showing us that Jesus is, because I think that's really the important theme here in chapter 7, and that the answer that we, the readers, are supposed to come to in these passages is that Jesus is indeed a great prophet, which is what the crowd says. Fear seized them all, and they glorified God, saying, a great prophet has arisen among us. And that we're supposed to see that this is Jesus is the new Elijah. So I just want to show you a couple other passages and then find out what you think about this, what it would mean for Old Testament people, what it means for us if Jesus is the new Elijah, and how we can reflect on that theme. Let me get some passages here. Okay, if you look further on in this chapter, okay, right after this in Luke 7, this report concerning him spread through the whole of Judea and all the surrounding country. So the news is going out now that Jesus raises dead people. Then comes this John the Baptist scene that we looked at yesterday, where John the Baptist and his disciples are hearing about this, and they send to Jesus. Now, this in chapter 7, they're starting to call Jesus more and more the Lord in narrative. If you look there in verse 19, John sent two of his disciples to the Lord, saying, and that's what is used in the narrative in verse 13 also, in this healing of the woman's son. It says, and when the Lord saw her, he had compassion on her. These are the first references in just narration to Jesus as Lord. The narrator, Luke, whoever, has slid these in at us now to point us to seeing who Jesus is. To this point, other people have called him Lord, you know, and he's said, why do you call me Lord, Lord? And it's been used as a title in speech. But now it's used actually in the narrative. Luke is starting to call Jesus the Lord, and he's leading us to see him as the Lord. So John sends his disciples saying, who are you? You know, are you the one who is to come? That would be Messiah. Or shall we look for someone else? And then Jesus refers to his miracles at that point. He does a few more, and then he says, go and tell John in verse 22 here what you have seen and heard. The blind receive their sight, the lame walk, lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear, and the dead are raised up. That would refer right back to this miracle that he's just done, you know, where he's raised that dead man. And the poor have good news preached to them. So Jesus now is telling John who he is. And then comes this little discussion about the contrast between Jesus and John. Interestingly, we did this last week, but eating is always an issue. Jesus was a glutton and a drunkard. He's got this terrible reputation. He must have really liked to eat and drink. And that becomes an issue of fasting and stuff. So that's the accusation in verse 34, I think. It's pretty funny. The Son of Man has come eating and drinking, and you say, behold, a glutton and a drunkard, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. You know, so he knew that people were accusing him of being this drunk, and has responded to that. Okay, and then comes this passage where Jesus then goes to eat. Again, he loved to go to people's house and eat. He eats at the house of one of the Pharisees, Simon. And Simon, too, is wondering, who is Jesus? Is he a prophet or not? That's the question that chapter 7 is asking. Is he a prophet? Is he Elijah? Who is he? So Simon's kind of watching to see what he does. And this woman, this was our gospel passage just a couple days ago. This woman comes in, interrupts, pours this flask of ointment on him, weeps, wipes him with her tears, and then Simon says, well, I guess he's not a prophet, because if this man were a prophet, he would know who this is. So Simon's trying to answer this question of, is Jesus a prophet or not, and he sees that Jesus isn't a prophet. But we, the reader, I think, are supposed to see that indeed he is. You know, so that's the, is he a prophet or not, this kind of question that's operating here in this whole chapter. All right, now flip over to chapter 9, if you would, where Herod is wondering who he is. Is he a prophet or not? Or who is this Jesus that we're hearing about? In chapter 9, verses 7 to 9, if someone would read that, I think this is an interesting. So, everybody's wondering, who is it? And Herod, too, is making the question, is this Elijah, one of the prophets, or who? And, you know, I guess what's important is these aren't necessarily the questions that would come to us. I mean, if you are trying to tell someone who Jesus is, you wouldn't necessarily describe him in Elijah terms and prophet terms. But I think the Old Testament connection is very, very important, and that's what Luke is wanting us to make. Just a couple more passages, and we can talk about why that's important to Luke and why it should be important to us if it should. Turn to 13 then, flip around to 13. We're just kind of doing a little proof texting journey here, which isn't good, but just want to point out some passages. In chapter 13, let's read 31 to 33, or 31 to 34. Well, let's read 31 to 35. Somebody want to read this?
At that very hour, some Pharisees came and said to him, "Get away from here, for Herod wants to kill you." And he said to them, "Go and tell that fox, 'Behold, I cast out demons and perform cures today and tomorrow, and the third day I finish my course. Nevertheless, I must go on my way today and tomorrow and the day following, for it cannot be that a prophet should perish away from Jerusalem. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, killing the prophets and stoning those who are sent to you, how often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wings, and you would not. Behold, your house is forsaken, and I tell you, you will not see me until you say, Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord."
Okay, so here too, Luke has Jesus calling himself a prophet and saying that he must go to Jerusalem to die because he's a prophet. And then finally, the other passage I wanted to refer you to is in the resurrection story in Luke 24, where more than any of the other Gospels, Luke grounds Jesus in the Old Testament and has the disciples, first of all, calling him a prophet, and then has Jesus himself interpreting all the scriptures to show that he is a prophet and that he's very much in that tradition. The Emmaus passage, we're not going to read the whole thing, but you recall after Jesus' death, the disciples walk along the road of Emmaus, and they're really bummed out, and they're talking with themselves about what they should do, and this stranger comes and joins them and talks with them and says, "What's going on?" And so they tell him the whole story. They can't believe that he hasn't heard of the events in that day. And in verse 19, in verse 18, it's funny, they say, "Are you the only visitor to Jerusalem who does not know the things that have happened there in these days?" And he said to them, "What things?" And they said to him, "Concerning Jesus of Nazareth, who was a prophet, mighty in deed and word before God and all the people." And then Jesus later, when he breaks the bread, you know, that's the moment at which they recognize him. And then he interprets all the prophets and the scriptures for them. And this is all unique to Luke, too, this business of calling. This whole story is. But I think a very important thing is that they're calling Jesus a prophet here. Okay, well, we've taken a long time here, but we've got about 6 or 7 minutes left to discuss. What would that mean? If Luke is trying to get readers here, or us, to ground Jesus in this whole Elijah, Elisha tradition, if indeed he's making the connection, and of course we could argue about that, you know, maybe we've seen enough differences in these two miracle stories that isn't really what's going on here. But if he's doing that, what does that mean for us? Who aren't such Elijah maniacs like the Jews were, or whatever. I mean, how can that enliven our faith? How can it enrich and deepen our faith in God to see Jesus in that way? Or what questions do you have? Anything you want to say? Or do you think about Elijah? I mean, I have to confess, I don't. Elijah isn't a real meaningful figure for me.
Only in terms of the fact that Malachi ends the Old Testament by saying that Elijah will return and turn the hearts of the children to their fathers and all that sort of thing again. Sylvia, kind of a renewal of the covenant. And probably that whole Jeremiah 31:31 that I'm going to write the covenant now on your hearts and not in the tablets of stone. And that's the only reason it's me.
Mm-hmm.
To me.
What about issues of continuity and discontinuity with the ultimate? Yeah, that Malachi passage is the key one. I mean, people were expecting Elijah. I think yesterday we looked at how Jesus is doing a new thing. In fact, I need to say, somebody called me on this, and it's a really important point. I use the word new age a lot, that Jesus is ushering in a new age, and I want to emphasize that we're not talking about new age religion, which I think is dangerous. I mean, it's especially big in the Pacific Northwest here, and that is not at all what I'm referring to, is that new age religion, but rather, so that's probably the wrong word to use, but that Jesus is bringing a new and radically different transformation of the world. The kingdom is dawning in Jesus, and it's new, it's earth-shaking. Today sort of is the contrast, that he's bringing a new kingdom, but he's grounding it in the tradition. He's tying himself very much to God, who is the same yesterday, today, and forever, whose prophets have always done miracles and been faithful to God and proclaimed God's faithfulness. So it's sort of, it's interesting in the issues of newness, oldness, continuity, discontinuity, all those kinds of things, too.
Kind of interesting that a Greek, Dr. Lucanus, should be intrigued by that Hebrew connection, except that maybe as a scientist he really wanted to have roots, to know the history of what he was proposing, you know, because he's really radically caught up by Christ.
This might not be what you're looking for, but I'm wondering, the people looked at Jesus, and they looked at him and they saw a prophet, and they saw Elijah. And I'm wondering if we claim to be the body of Christ, do people look at us as Christians, not maybe individually, but as a whole, do some people see Elijah? Do they see a prophet? Do they see a person with power and justice for people?
Or do they see a community that killed 6 million Jews,
right,
and seems to hate the people of the Old Testament faith? Right.
So if we were to resemble the body of Christ, it sounds like we should try to resemble Elijah somewhat, because that's what people look at Jesus, they see Elijah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an interesting question. I'm not looking for anything specific. I'm just sort of wondering in myself, you know, what it means. So go ahead.
To me, this is a reminder that when we offer the good news, which was what Luke is offering, he offers it within a context that those people will understand by relating back to what they already knew. And I think I need to continually be aware of the fact that when I offer the good news, I have to offer it in such a way that it is meaningful to the person, and that may be different for different people. We don't just, you know, these patent answers and formulas that are often given, I think are meaningless, because we have to take people where they are within the context of their living situation and make the offering in terms that are meaningful to them. So I guess that's what it mm-hmm. speaks to me about in some ways here.
Oh, that's really... Barbara, is there any connection, or have you thought about the fact that Elijah didn't die in the same way we did?
Yeah, I think that's probably why the idea got circulating that he was going to come back, right? Because remember, he got taken away in that chariot, you know? Somebody who knows that story really well.
Was he dead or alive dead? You know, was he in some state waiting to be...
Well, I think that was the idea circulating at Jesus' time, was that since Elijah hadn't died, that he was somewhere getting ready to come back, you know? And that was a connection with Messiah too that was being expected. I don't really know enough about that whole thing, but I think that's why Elijah was the one person who could come back, sort of, is that he hadn't really died, and he had left in his chariot. Didn't he say he was going to come back? We should look at that story here if I can find it. Now you see how little I know about Elijah. Oh let's see if we can find it. Where is it? It's after.
Kings 2, 2 Kings 2.
All right, let's look at it.
I just opened it up to there.
Oh, you lucky person. Okay. All right. Okay, let's start with, well, we could just read that little section 9 through 12. But that doesn't really get to the whole history of it. Anyway, I mean, Elijah has already called Elisha. You know, he threw his mantle over him and stuff, and now Elijah's getting ready to go. Somebody want to read that? Or maybe we should start further back with like 4, I don't know. Well, somebody just read 9 through 12, okay?
When they arrived on the other side, Elijah said to Elisha, "What wish shall I grant you before I am taken away?" And Elisha replied, "Please grant me twice as much prophetic power as you have had." "You have asked a hard thing," Elijah replied. "If you see me when I am taken from you, then you will get your request. But if not, then you won't."
Do you want to keep going?
Oh. As they were walking alone, talking, suddenly a chariot of fire, drawn by horses of fire, appeared and drove between them, separating them, and Elijah was carried by a whirlwind into heaven. Elijah saw it and cried out, my father, the chariot of Israel and the charioteers." As they disappeared from sight, he tore his robe. Then he picked up Elijah's cloak and returned to the bank of the Jordan River and struck the water with it. "Where is the Lord God of Elijah?" he cried out. And the water parted and Elijah went across.
Okay, let's stop there. So he doesn't here say that he's coming back, but anyway, he doesn't die. There's no sort of, the other person whose death we're not told of is Enoch, and there was always a sense in Genesis that he might come back too, because he didn't die and get buried, and that's the key. You got to die and get buried, or else you might come back. You're not really dead. So Elijah is taken away in this chariot. And let's just look quickly at the Malachi passage, then we can go to coffee break. At the very end of the Old Testament, as Mark said, in Malachi 4, this is the last passage in the Old Testament here.
"Remember the law of my servant Moses, the statutes and ordinances that I commanded him at Horeb and for all Israel. Behold, I will send you Elijah, the prophet, before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes. And he will turn the hearts of fathers to their children and the hearts of children to their fathers, lest I come and smite the land with a curse."
And then starts the New Testament. So that's it. So there is that sense, that prophecy that I will send you Elijah, and then he'll teach and preach. So, well, that's probably enough said. Anyway, tomorrow we're going to look at the stilling of the storm. We're going to move off for a day off of the healing miracles and go to the whole issue of nature miracles. So we'll look at that one especially in Luke 8, if you want to look at that ahead of time, and then talk about issues of Jesus' relationship with creation and with nature, some of the other nature miracles as well, and what's going on, what Luke is trying to show us about Jesus here.